It's the 6th of November, 2025, and you're listening to Weekly Reveille here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is Chuck Kaufman, your volunteer reader and flying staff, bringing you news of interest to our veterans community here in Arizona. And today we have news from our military news websites, as well as our veteran service organizations, publications, and websites, and of course, the latest announcements from the Veterans Administration, from VA.gov and others. Our first article is by Patricia Keim, and she reports for MilitaryTimes.com. GOP Senator proposes commission to study VA disability ratings system. This is from the 30th of October. In the wake of a Washington Post investigation into fraud within the Veterans Affairs disability system and watchdog recommendations that the VA modernize its rating schedule, a Republican senator suggested creating a commission to review the VA's disability compensation program. As Senate Veterans Affairs Committee hearing on Wednesday in Washington, Senator Tommy Tuberville, Republican of Alabama, questioned whether the Veterans Benefit Administration, the VA arm that manages disability compensation, pensions, education, and employment benefits, needs subject matter experts to examine the claims processes and recommend improvements. According to Tuberville, the panel would be similar to the VA's Commission on Care, which reviewed the VA's healthcare system in the mid-2010s and made recommendations on veterans' military, or rather medical, services. The VA also had an Asset and Infrastructure Review Commission that reviewed the VA hospital system in the early 2020s and made recommendations to modernize it. Those efforts resulted in mixed success, with some recommendations adopted, such as consolidating the VA's community care programs and expanding access to urgent care and emergency care. But others, including the AIR's commission's recommendation to realign or close dozens of medical centers and clinics, were blocked. The Government Accountability Office has recommended the VA improve management of compensation programs and update its disability rating schedule. It has put VBA on its high-risk list for significant waste mismanagement and needs broad transformation, Elizabeth Kurda, GAO's Acting Director of Healthcare, said during a hearing Wednesday. A commission to address these concerns may not be the right approach, said Ryan Gallucci, Executive Director of the Veterans of Foreign Wars Washington office. Gallucci said veterans service organizations generally have welcomed commission reviews, but will object to any recommendations they see as reductions to VA services or facilities. I get nervous about the prospect of a commission, Gallucci said. I remember with the AIR commission that it couldn't make it past the first marker, and now we're seeing the repercussions of that. I would argue that a forum like this is certainly a good start to have these discussions. The Washington Post recently published several articles showcasing veterans who have abused the VA disability compensation system, saying the $193 billion program is a target for fraud, including veterans who fake injuries or illnesses for money. The Post cited VA's own Office of Inspector General reports and Freedom of Information Act documents that showed veterans who claimed to be paralyzed for years could walk or feign blindness to collect, at least in one case, nearly $400,000 in VA disability payments. Nearly universally at the hearing, witnesses and lawmakers panned the reports, calling them harmful and shaming, blaming veterans for the actions of outliers and not addressing the system itself. The articles failed to understand or capture the purpose of disability compensation. Instead, they cherry-pick anecdotes to wrongly claim the disability benefit system is fraught with widespread fraud, said Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, the committee's ranking Democrat. Blumenthal conceded that fraud does occur, but said the system should not be abandoned as a result. Retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Gade, a West Point graduate and Iraq War veteran, was a lone voice in the room, criticizing the system, which he said incentivizes veterans to increase their disability ratings and discourages them from working or taking steps to improve their health by complying with treatment. Gade said, the current system robs veterans of purpose and dignity, trapping them in idleness and despair. This system is anti-thriving, anti-productivity, and ultimately anti-veteran. Further, it discourages future generations serving by painting veterans as a troubled problem class, said Gade, who once served as Virginia's Veterans Commissioner of Veterans Affairs Services. According to VA Inspector General Cheryl Mason, 3.7% of fraud cases investigated by her office involve those perpetrated by veterans, and the largest percentage of fraud investigated by the OIG is against VA and veterans. The Veterans Services Organization that testified had several solutions for fixing the system and ensuring that veterans receive appropriate compensation. Jeremy Villanueva, Associate Legislative Director for Paralyzed Veterans of America, said the department needed to improve oversight of compensation and pension exams done by contractors and conduct more thorough reviews of claims paperwork submitted by veterans. John Retzer, Assistant National Legislative Director at Disabled American Veterans, said the VA must resource its claims department and optimize technology to streamline the application and approval process. Gade recommended an overhaul of a system that gives ratings for illnesses such as hypertension, forgive the expression, old fat people conditions, he said, requiring veterans receive mental health treatment if they get disability compensation for a mental health disorder, and providing VA medical care for all service-connected conditions without tying them to disability ratings, removing an incentive for false claims. Tuberville did not say whether he will propose legislation to create a commission. Mason said the idea would be very well placed. I think it's needed to look at the VBA process like it's supposed to do at VHA, Mason said. Committee Chairman Jerry Moran, Republican of Kansas, promised more on the topic. This is not the first and will not be the last conversation we have in exploring how to better serve veterans and improve the disability system, Moran said. And that's GOP Senator proposes commission to study VA disability ratings system. We'll turn now to Stripes.com for an article by Linda F. Hershey along those same lines. Disability fraud is a tiny fraction of VA claims, advocates say. This is also from the 30th of October, Washington. Veterans advocates and Democrat lawmakers slammed a recent newspaper report critical of the disability benefits system run by the Department of Veterans Affairs for cherry-picking cases from millions of claims properly awarded to sick and injured former service members. The October 6th story by the Washington Post examined 25 years of VA disability claims and pointed to instances of fraud and exaggerations in claims filed by veterans for disability benefits. But the nation's primary veteran service organizations disputed the findings at a hearing Wednesday of the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. The groups also released written statements that denounced the Post's reporting. Disabled American veterans, veterans of foreign wars, and paralyzed veterans of America complained that the coverage failed to address how disability compensation is awarded for the invisible wounds of military service that include post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury. DAV said the cases of abuse cited in the Post story represent just a tiny fraction of the 6.9 million disabled veterans' claims that are completely legitimate. Senator Tammy Duckworth, Democrat of Illinois, a disabled Army National Guard veteran, said sick and injured veterans filing claims should not be stereotyped as moochers. She cautioned against making major changes to the disability system. In fiscal 2024, the VA granted benefits to 1.1 million veterans and their survivors. There are about 18 million veterans in the U.S. Millions of veterans depend on disability compensation from VA to help them cope with serious health conditions they experienced while serving our country, said Senator Jerry Moran, Republican of Kansas, chairman of the Senate Committee on Veterans Affairs. Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, the top-ranking Democrat on the committee, said there's some wrongdoing to root out, but warned lawmakers not to abandon a system of compensation deserved and needed by veterans. Cheryl Mason, VA Inspector General, said, "There's no massive fraud going on. I take issue with the Post story," she said. But Daniel M. Gade, a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel, criticized the disability system and said VA's monthly payments to qualifying veterans reward unemployment and disengagement. "The disability system robs veterans of purpose and dignity, leading them not to pursue work after leaving the military," he said. "Only in the VA system are flat feet and tinnitus a disability," Gade said. The Post responded October 14th to the pushback by veterans groups, stating that its coverage found that veterans advocates, for-profit companies, and VA itself encourage vets to file as many claims as possible to maximize their benefits and milk the system. But John Retzer, Deputy National Legislative Director at Disabled American Veterans, said, "The Post reporting suggests that tinnitus, diabetes, and PTSD are dubious as service-connected conditions, even though Congress has long recognized the conditions as valid. Paralyzed Veterans of America questioned why veteran service groups were not interviewed for the story, as they represent millions of veterans. As a veteran with a real combat-related service-connected condition incurred while serving with the 82nd Airborne, I do not begrudge veterans for seeking benefits and services to which they have earned and are entitled to by law," said Carl Blake, Chief Executive Officer for Paralyzed Veterans of America, in a written statement. Veterans groups faulted the Post story for overlooking the impact of the 2022 PACT Act that compensated veterans exposed to toxins from burn pits, Agent Orange, and other hazards. The PACT Act was behind a large increase in disability compensation and not massive fraud, Democrat lawmakers said. "Combat wounds are not the only occupational hazards of military service," said Carol Whitmore, Commander-in-Chief at Veterans of Foreign Wars, in a written statement. "The daily grind of service, exposure to toxic environments, repeated concussions, sleep deprivation, moral injury, sexual trauma, constant stress, and grueling physical demands leaves lasting scars." And that article from Stripes.com, "Disability Fraud is a Tiny Fraction of VA Claims," advocates say. Returning to MilitaryTimes.com, we have VA tech glitch halts GI Bill payments to thousands, advocates say. This article is by Hope Hodge-Sack from the 3rd of November. 2 months after an IT hiccup at the Department of Veterans Affairs left a significant portion of GI Bill recipients without their anticipated payments for school and housing, some advocates have a message for the VA: turn the GI Bill hotline back on. Those missing payments in the wake of the rollout of a new processing system are spouses or children of veterans who have died or missing or have a permanent and total service-connected disability, grouped together under the VA's Chapter 35. Up to 75,000 of these claims may be unpaid, according to Ashlyn Haycock-Lohman, Director of Government and Legislative Affairs for the Tragedy Assistance Program for Survivors. And while VA officials lay the blame for the protracted payments delay largely with congressional Democrats, whom the administration holds responsible for the government shutdown that began October 1st, multiple groups are expressing frustration with the department's own actions and failure to find a solution. VA deployed a new benefit delivery system in August and anticipated having the ability to pay staff overtime and deploy automation solutions as needed to ensure a smooth transition and process fall enrollments on a timely basis, Peter Kasperowitz, VA spokesman, told Military Times in an emailed statement. "When the Democrat shutdown hit, VA was deprived of these resources." He added that federal law required the GI Bill hotline, which is typically used to identify and address payment issues, to be turned off during the shutdown. VA anticipates the pay issue won't be fully resolved until late November or early December, Kasperowitz said. That's not satisfactory to Haycock-Lohman. "The shutdown is not the cause of this, and it needs to be very clear that the reason that this happened is because VA's infrastructure failed, and they chose not to tell us until after the shutdown started," she said. "VA could have told us in August." She added that affected veterans never got clear communication about what was happening due to a communications plan that was upended after VA staff got furloughed in October. An October 9th letter to VA Secretary Doug Collins from Senator Richard Blumenthal, a Democrat of Connecticut, and Representative Mark Takano, Democrat of California, the ranking members of the Senate and House Veterans Affairs Committees, expressed serious concern at the missed payments and gave the VA an October 13th deadline to provide an explanation, outline the scope of the problem, and explain its communications plan. These payments are essential, mandatory funds that veterans and their families rely on for food, rent, or mortgage payments, immediate needs, and financial stability, the lawmakers wrote. A staff member with Blumenthal's office said VA had not yet sent a response to that letter. They added that VA had told congressional staff in August about a glitch that would affect 900 Chapter 35 students, saying the students had been contacted and the issue remediated. But no further information had been forthcoming, even as the issue appears to be much larger and they believe VA has not done any outreach about the matter. Will Hubbard, the Vice President for Veterans and Military Policy at the organization Veterans Education Success and an architect of the current Forever GI Bill, has been tracking the non-payment issue closely since he was alerted to the problem by congressional staff. There's been no mass communications plan. There's no press release. There's no public anything, Hubbard said, and that's really been a fundamental issue. For Hubbard, the problem is also fit a pattern of major VA platform or tech rollouts affecting GI Bill beneficiaries that took place right before the start of the fall semester, when enrollments were surging and tuition payments were coming due. Hubbard wants assurances from the VA that the rollout timing issue will be addressed for the future. He's also concerned that the VA's projected timeline for fixing the current problem is optimistic and expressed concern about the destabilizing impacts of missing payments that roll into next semester. What I'm most worried about are the housing payment elements of this issue, he said, because, you know, a school might be flexible, and I applaud that, but I suspect that landlords, their patience is going to run thin eventually. It's bad, obviously, to get dropped from school, but it's life-changing if you're put out on the street. TAPS, meanwhile, is calling for the restoration of the GI Bill hotline and a surge in claims processors to accelerate resolution. What they should be doing is bringing back the call center, finding a way to fund the call center, bring those employees back, Haycock Lohman said. In future shutdown plans, make it very clear that the GI Bill hotline needs to be considered an essential program, and they need to bring back every processor right now. TAP staff said they had seen success in back-channel communication with congressional officials and VA Education Services over specific hardship cases to restore payments. Haycock Lohman said all affected students should know that schools are legally prohibited from dropping them over missed GI Bill payments. And, she said, survivors facing issues can reach TAPS for help with their case at casework@taps.org. That's VA Tech Glitch Halts GI Bill Payments to Thousands, advocates say. Now we have a couple of items from military history. First, in this salute to veterans, meet the World War II ace and Medal of Honor recipient who mastered the P-47. This is by John Gutman of MilitaryTimes.com from the 31st of October. Many of the most successful fighter pilots gained fame not only for their aerial tactics, but for their ability to pass their knowledge on to others. Ironically, some of those who handed down their tactical dictum to their men died because on one hubris-guided moment they disobeyed their own advice. Among these victims of their own negligence were World War I ace of aces, Manfred von Richthofen, and second-ranking American total World War II ace, Thomas B. McGuire, Jr. Yet another cautionary tale was left by Neil Kirby. While a second lieutenant in the Army Reserves in 1938, Kirby shot up the ranks after World War II broke out. Captain on February 1, 1942, Major on March 1st and Lieutenant Colonel on November 28th. In October 1942, Kirby was put in charge of a new unit, the 348th Fighter Group. It was the first outfit shipped to 5 Fighter Command in New Guinea, equipped with the Republic P-47D Thunderbolt, a huge, sturdy, single-engine fighter armed with 8 wing-mounted 50-caliber machine guns. American fighter jockeys in the South Pacific generally preferred the Lockheed P-38G Lightning, which had proven a highly successful ace maker, while dismissing the P-47 Jug as too heavy and not maneuverable enough to dogfight nimble lightweights such as the Japanese Navy's Zero and the Army's Nakajima Ki-43 Hayabusa. Once in command, however, Kirby became a hardcore believer in the P-47 and devoted himself to developing a doctrine for making the most of the Thunderbolt's diving speed while canceling out the Japanese advantages. When the 348th moved to Port Moresby, Papua New Guinea, on July 14, 1943, its pilots had trained well under Kirby's tutelage, and its first combat flight on August the 16th yielded its first victim, a Ki-43 of the 59th Koku Sentai, or Air Regiment, downed by 2nd Lieutenant Wilbur C. Henderson. In spite of being 32 years of age, practically ancient by USAAF standards, Kirby was a believer in leading by example, and on September the 4th, he scored his first victories, a Mitsubishi G4M bomber and one of its Zero escorts. 10 days later, he outran and downed a Mitsubishi Ki-46, a twin-engine reconnaissance built for speed. On September 23rd, he was promoted to colonel. Then, on October 11th, he shot down 6 Japanese aircraft in a matter of 15 minutes, a feat that led to his being awarded the Medal of Honor from General Douglas MacArthur on January 23rd, 1944. Over the next few months, Kirby and the 348th established themselves as forces to be reckoned with over New Guinea. On January 9, 1944, he downed 2 fighters, bringing his score up to 21. At that point, he was dividing his attention between flying alongside the 348th and, after November the 12th, 1943, flying a desk in 5 Fighter Command, while Lieutenant Colonel Robert Richard Rowland assumed command of the 348th. Kirby's superior in 5th Air Force, Major General George C. Kinney, encouraged this arrangement to stir up a rivalry between aces, as he was already doing with P-38 champions Richard I. Bong and Tommy McGuire. Besides bringing out the deadly best in these outstanding pilots and pitting the P-38s against Kirby's P-47, the publicity it generated kept the 5th Air Force in the public eye and attracted re-equipment stateside. On February the 8th, 1944, Kenny put Kirby in command of the 308th Bombardment Group, Heavy, and it was during this command that Kirby forgot his own dictum. On March the 5th, 1944, Kirby was leading Captain Samuel Blair and William D. Dunham at 22,000 feet altitude over enemy airfields at Wewak when, at 17:20 hours, they spotted 3 Kawasaki Ki-48 bombers heading toward Daguia for a landing. The Japanese at Daguia spotted their comrade's plight, however, and the 77th Sentai scrambled 5 Ki-43s up after the intruders. Diving on their prey, each American ace was credited with 1, but Kirby was not sure of his and circled around to make another pass. His 22nd victim splashed in the sea, but in making that second pass at relatively low altitude and reduced airspeed, he handed the advantage to the Hayabusas. The 77th Sentai's log credited a P-47 each to Warrant Officer Koichi Mitoma and Sergeant Hiroshi Aoyagi, while suffering 1 plane badly damaged. In July 1947, Australian Wargraves personnel found Kirby in the wreckage of his plane, Fiery Ginger 4, just 1,800 feet from Daguia. The only intact remnant, the white vertical stabilizer bearing the serial 42-22-668, was returned to the U.S., and in 2001 it was put on display at the National Museum of the United States Air Force beside a rebuilt plane in his markings. Kirby's remains were laid to rest at Sparkman Hillcrest Memorial Park. Besides the Medal of Honor, Kirby was awarded 2 Silver Stars, 4 Distinguished Flying Crosses, 5 Air Medals, and 1 Purple Heart. In 1959, a building on Shepherd Air Force Base is named in his honor, and in 2010, the Texas Historical Commission and City of Arlington unveiled a plaque and a statue of him in the Arlington Public Library. Just as an aside, I have seen that aircraft, his P-47, at the Museum of the Air Force in Dayton. And additionally, if you're interested in the Race of Aces that was mentioned, that was sponsored by General Kenney, that is available in a book. And it's quite interesting because it talks about the P-38 pilots that were competing against one another to see who could shoot down the most Japanese airplanes. That article was Meet the World War II Ace and Medal of Honor Recipient Who Mastered the P-47. We have a story of another Medal of Honor winner. This also from MilitaryTimes.com. The AEF lost his Medal of Honor paperwork. It took nearly 70 years to correct. This also from the 31st of October by John Gutman and Nicole Bauke. Out of a hailstorm of machine gun fire and heavy shelling, Private Burton Holmes returned badly wounded to the 371st Infantry Regiment's command post. His unit had been set up, lured out onto Hill 188 by the false promise of surrender, leaving them vulnerable to the surprise attack from the Germans. But Holmes returned only because his automatic rifle was out of commission. He refused to be taken to the hospital for treatment. Instead, he got a reserve automatic rifle and rejoined the fight, firing upon the enemy until he died. His try or die attitude was shared by all of Company C. His fellow soldier, Corporal Freddie Stowers, continued to crawl ahead after being mortally wounded. He too died under fire while encouraging the unit to advance. For their actions in the Battle of Hill 188 on September 28, 1918, both Holmes and Stowers were recommended for the Medal of Honor. Only Stowers, however, would receive the nation's highest military honor 73 years after the soldier's death. Born on January 12, 1896, in Sandy Springs, South Carolina, Stowers, the grandson of a slave, was working on a farm as a farmhand when America declared war on Germany, and he was drafted into the Army at Williamston, South Carolina, on October 4, 1917. After training at Camp Jackson in April 1918, he was assigned to Company C, 1st Battalion, 371st Infantry Regiment, 93rd Division, American Expeditionary Forces, and shipped off to France. Organized at Camp Jackson, the 371st Infantry was one of 4 segregated black regiments slated for France, of which one, the 369th, was relatively experienced. The 371st, in contrast, was made up of draftees, mostly from South Carolina, but reinforced with soldiers from Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, Maryland, and Pennsylvania. Although combined on paper as the 93rd Division, provisional, the 371st was confined by the AEF for auxiliary and labor roles behind the lines. That state of affairs changed, however, when the French Army, in dire need of reinforcements at a critical turning point of the war, requested and received black units. Among those French units in need was 157th Division, the Red Hand, under General Mariano Guibert, which had been decimated at Chemin des Dames in May. On July 4th, the division was reconstituted with the French 333rd Infantry Regiment and the 371st and 372nd Regiments, then redeployed to the front. By mid-September, the 157th had acquired the experience necessary to hold its sector at Avaucourt and Varèse, northwest of Verdun. In C Company of the 371st, Stowers had risen to corporal in charge of half a squad. On September 26, the AEF and French launched their Meuse-Argonne campaign. On the 28th, C Company of the 371st advanced on its objective, Côte 188, a 188-meter-high hill overlooking a farm near Ardelle et Montefoel. As the black troops made their way forward and up, a line of Germans emerged from their positions, at least one holding a white flag. When the 371st men closed to 100 meters, however, the surrendering Germans suddenly dropped into the trenches, and others rose to man machine guns, rifles, and mortars in interlocking fields of fire. In a matter of minutes, half of the approaching 371st were cut down and the rest driven to ground. In C Company, Corporal Stowers took in the situation around him and discovered that his company commander and sergeant were dead, and all other senior personnel were casualties, leaving him the highest grade still standing. His response was to crawl his way upward, gathering up men left standing. Managing to reach the first German trench line, Stowers and his men destroyed the key machine gun position and killed the defenders. Stowers then regrouped the men on hand and continued his crawl up the hill. As they approached the second trench lines, however, he was struck by a machine gun round. Even then, he continued to urge his troops forward until he finally fell dead. By then, his leadership by example had left its mark on C Company as it overran the second line and drove the Germans from, quote, 188. Although he would go no further, Stowers inspired the 371st Infantry to further successes at Bussy-Ferme, Ardelles, Montrefoel, and Triers-Ferme, albeit at the cost of 133 killed in action. I apologize for my French pronunciation of these places. In 1990, however, the Army conducted a reappraisal of minorities whose deeds may have been underrated during World War I. As a result, on April 24, 1991, two of Stowers' sisters, Georgina Palmer and Mary Jane Bowens, were invited to the White House to receive Stowers' overdue Medal of Honor. Today, Stowers remains not far from where he fell in the Meuse-Argonne American Cemetery and Memorial at Romain-sous-Montfaucon. In that article, the AEF lost his Medal of Honor paperwork. It took nearly 70 years to correct. You're listening to Weekly Reveille on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. If you've ever wanted to listen to Weekly Reveille or any other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming at a time of your choosing, or just as it streams, you can go to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org or by downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app from the Apple App Store for your iPhone or iPad or the Google Play Store for your Android phone or tablet. And you can always listen to Weekly Reveille and other programming as it streams on your Amazon Dot, Echo, or Show. With Veterans Day coming up next week and the anniversary of a number of our oldest military services, the Marines, the Navy, and the Army, we have this item from the November issue of Military Officer Magazine, Revisiting the Revolution. New series from Ken Burns takes a multifaceted view. The American Revolution, one of the most decisive and consequential events in American history, forged a path that our country continues to follow more than 250 years later. Following his series, The Civil War, Jazz, and the Vietnam War, documentarian Ken Burns sets his sights on this pivotal period of time when the colonies fought to escape British rule and earn independence. Unfolding over 6 2-hour chapters, the American Revolution offers a detailed, multidimensional portrait of the history, people, culture, geography, and politics of the era, told from dual perspectives of modern-day experts and historians and the real people who lived through and influenced its events. Burns, working alongside co-directors Sarah Botstein and David Schmidt, starts a 12-hour journey ahead of the start of the Revolutionary War, which began April 19, 1775, with the battles of Lexington and Concord. Appropriately, the filmmakers trace the June 14, 1775 formation of the Continental Army, the first national military force, followed later that year by the creation of the Navy in October and the Marine Corps in November. more than simply chronicling the political and physical battles that took place during the eight-year conflict, writer, historian, and frequent Burns collaborator Jeffrey Ward examines the far-reaching repercussions of the American Revolution, from its immediate transformation of territorial and trade maps to the longer-term worldwide effects on democratic principles. Taking a holistic approach was necessary from both a contemporary perspective and an historic one, Schmid said. This story doesn't make sense without taking into account all the things that somebody like, say, George Washington was taking into account, Schmidt told military officer in an interview. If you look at his papers, he's talking about indigenous people and enslaved people and factoring them into the calculus of how to fight and win this war. To not do so would have been malpractice. Ward, recipient of 7 Emmys, comes to the project with a well-established pedigree of writing military and military-adjacent projects, including The Civil War, The War, about World War II, and The U.S. and the Holocaust. By incorporating reams of historical documentation, readings of firsthand accounts, and insights from several dozen scholars and experts, the screenwriter provided a narrative that was thorough, informative, and richly entertaining. Jeff always says that history is a conversation, Botstein told military officer. You want the narration to weave together the actual chronological story of events and as accurately and historically sound as possible, and then you have the personal experiences of the people who lived through it, and the historians help the viewer understand it, she said. And then you want the viewer to draw their own conclusions, ask their own questions, and be interested in the subject. Shooting over a period of several years, Burns, Botstein, and Schmidt further strove for authenticity by enlisting a cast of hundreds to reenact moments during the Revolutionary War period, from mundane daily realities to violent conflicts. To capture their footage, they traveled to many historic locations, including Fort Ticonderoga, New York, and Colonial Williamsburg, Jamestown Settlement, and Mount Vernon in Virginia. The intention was to evoke events of the Revolution on screen, as Ward's narration, delivered by actor Peter Coyote and an international voice cast including Tom Hanks, Morgan Freeman, Paul Giamatti, Meryl Streep, and Edward Norton, provides relevant information. Schmidt said the production invariably proved educational for everyone involved, even coming into it armed with Ward's dense and detailed script. If you'd asked me 10 years ago what liberty, freedom, and independence mean, I would tell you that they're direct synonyms. And they're not, he said. But we're not trying to undo anybody's understanding. We're just trying to start from square one again and build it back up. It's only 12 hours. That's a lot, but it cannot be close to comprehensive on a subject where literally millions of people were involved, he acknowledged. So we're trying to get as much space as we can in that space, trying to be as objective as we can and tell a good story. We want people to enjoy the film and learn a lot. This article is by Todd Gilchrist, a film critic based in Los Angeles, Revisiting the Revolution, from the Military Officer magazine. Our next item, Veterans Day Parade, Phoenix. This is from Honoring America's Veterans, and they have a countdown to the 2025 HAV Veterans Day Parade in Phoenix, and that's on the honoringamericasveterans.org website. They have a street closure map there. The parade will head south on Central Avenue from Montebello Drive, turn east onto Camelback Road, turn south onto 7th Street, and end at Indian School Road. The parade will end at approximately 1 p.m. Parade program. We host an honor and recognition events to salute our veterans and their loved ones by thanking, honoring, and recognizing them for their service and patriotism to our country. The best place to watch the parade is on Camelback Road, as it has the least number of spectators. Bring your small tents, chairs, and coolers for this free, family-friendly event. Started in 1997, the Honoring America's Veterans Day Parade, Phoenix, recognizes the contributions of our United States veterans. The parade helps build a patriotic Phoenix community spirit that recognizes the sacrifices veterans make for our country. The parade couldn't happen without the generous support of our community, our sponsors, the parade organizers, the Honoring Arizona's Veterans Board, and our parade participants. From the parade map, the Phoenix Veterans Day Parade begins at 11 a.m. and it heads south on Central Avenue from Montebello Drive to Camelback Road, turning east on Camelback Road to 7th Street, then turning south on 7th Street and ending at Indian School Road. The 2025 Celebrity Grand Marshal will be Randy Couture. He's a U.S. Army veteran, a 6 times UFC champion, and an accomplished actor. Before he became a heavyweight champion, movie star, and entrepreneur, Randy Couture was a young man in Army Green, training, wrestling, and discovering what he was truly made of. From 1982 to 1988, Couture served with pride in the 101st Airborne Division, rising to the rank of sergeant. His years in uniform didn't just shape his body, they shaped his mind, his leadership, and his future. The business community Grand Marshal, Freddie Alvarez. He's a U.S. Navy Submarine Service veteran, the owner of 5 companies. Alvarez's leadership style blends strategic discipline with entrepreneurial courage. Drawing from his military precision and global business experience, he's built a reputation for identifying opportunities, empowering teams, and driving sustainable growth. His ability to turn challenges into measurable results has made him a respected figure in both the private and veteran business communities. Then they have an item, learn more about the 2025 Veterans Grand Marshals. Honoring America's Veterans hosts and Honor Our Heroes Veterans Grand Marshals competition each year, where community members nominate veterans to serve as Grand Marshals. If selected, the Marshals serve as a representative for their era of service. They also ride in the parade, have their bios printed in the parade program and online, and receive other special recognition to make this a memorable experience. And on this website, they have links to the various bios for these Grand Marshals. The first is Charlie Johnson, who will be representing World War II veterans. Then Jerry Santee will be representing Korean War veterans. Roger Sandine, representing Vietnam War veterans. Carl Faulkner, representing the Cold War veterans. Kathy Gallowitz, representing Desert Storm veterans. Wesley Brandon Reed, representing Operation Enduring Freedom, or Afghanistan veterans. And finally, Rick Kreiberg, representing Operation Iraqi Freedom veterans. They have a number of essay competition winners that they list on the websites, as well as the sponsors for that Veterans Day Parade. And that's the Phoenix Veterans Day Parade, beginning at 11 a.m. on the 11th of November. Our next item is from news.va.gov. VA launches offline mobile app to support HBPC teams in remote areas. The new app provides support to veterans in remote areas. This is from the 24th of October by Alan Greilsamer, VA EHRM Communications. Home-based primary care, HBPC, teams now have a faster and more secure way to support veterans in remote areas, even those without internet access, thanks to the recent implementation of the Oracle Health Community Care app, formerly known as Mobile Care. The app allows HBPC staff to view critical patient information, including documentation, orders, medications, labs, and histories in an offline, read-only capacity, enabling providers to deliver consistent, high-quality care in rural or low-connectivity areas. The app also has additional features, such as essential risk assessments and offline free text documents, saving time and reducing disruptions. This marks a major improvement over previous workflows, which required staff to log in to laptops, connect to hotspots, access virtual private networks, and launch Citrix to reach patient records. Now staff can open a patient chart directly at the point of care, saving time and reducing disruptions. The app is in use across all 6 facilities that are live with the federal electronic health record, and performance so far has been strong. From August 22nd through mid-September, 97% of the nearly 1,400 transactions conducted in the app, such as opening a patient chart, submitting a lab order, or saving a note, were completed in under 2 seconds. I had a patient move and use the app to find their new home while in the field, said Jessica Berger, a dietitian at Mann Grand Staff VA Medical Center in Spokane, Washington. I've used some advanced filters on my documents to pull up notes by author or note type for ease of access. It makes finding some of the notes very easy. I can view them in ad hoc notes. I also bring my laptop into the home for visits, so I will use it to document in ad hoc while I reference other information on the phone app. This saves me time. The app, available on government-furnished iOS devices such as iPhones and iPads, can also improve data safety and security. By giving HBPC staff access to records directly on their devices instead of printing out patient charts or taking handwritten notes, it reduces the risk of sensitive patient data being lost or mishandled. Beyond added convenience, the app also supports stronger engagement with veterans. Staff can use the app during visits to show veterans trends in their health information, helping them better understand the importance of their treatment plans. By equipping HBPC teams with mobile access to patient records without needing internet access, the Oracle Health Community Care app helps staff deliver care more efficiently, securely, and effectively. For more information and resources, visit the EHR Modernization website. That's available at www.ehrm.va.gov. And that's VA launches offline mobile app to support HBPC teams in remote areas. Our next article is from the 30th of September, Chasing the Next Healing: Journey from Addiction and Despair to Recovery and Hope with VA Support. This is by Travis Otto, compensated work therapy veteran, West Palm Beach, VA. At nearly 60 years old, James Obermesick has lived through more than most. He served 4 years in the Air Force, endured dozens of surgeries, and weathered the pain of a fractured family. For a time, his spirit broke under the weight of it all. But today, he's still standing, still fighting, and slowly learning how to live again, discovering, perhaps for the first time, that he deserves to. That's because since his teenage years, smoking and drinking was his vice of choice, and they had taken a toll. Struggling with addiction and mental health, substances crept more into his hands as Obermesick returned from service with an honorable discharge and an injured back. He spiraled into drugs, into deeper depression, and into survival mode. Despite his longing for a clean way forward, he spiraled into darkness after service, constantly chasing the next high. Today, Obermesick is clear-eyed and candid, sitting in the safety of the VA Medical Center. If it weren't for this place, he said, I'd be dead, no question. From 1955 to 2023, Obermesick was misdiagnosed, misprescribed, and misunderstood. It was not until 2024 that he received a proper mental health diagnosis, bipolar disorder. A miracle changed everything. With the right treatment, everything changed. It was like a miracle, he said. Suddenly, the impulses weren't winning anymore. For the first time in decades, I had control. Obermesick had cycled through shelters, psychiatric hospitals, and temporary programs for years, but nothing stuck. Not until a social worker at Fort Pierce VA Clinic asked a simple question, "Are you a veteran?" That moment triggered a chain of events that led Obermesick to the West Palm Beach VA and to the Domiciliary Care for Homeless Veterans program. It wasn't easy for him. The domiciliary is a place of structure, healing, and accountability. But Obermesick knew what was at stake. If it were not for my sister and a social worker at VA, I wouldn't have gotten the help I really needed. I thought I was coming here to lose my freedom, but what I really lost were my chains. I know what it's like to live for the next high. Now I want to live for the next healing, he shared, nearing the completion of his domiciliary program. From being surrounded by drugs and regrets to now protecting his peace, take it from this Air Force veteran. There is always a chance to turn things around. For anyone reading this, if you're a veteran and you're in the darkness, I want you to know, VA saved my life, he added. There's an SOS being sent out, but only you can choose to answer it. If you want to grab that life vest just once more, VA is there, but you must take the first step. The domiciliary program was established in the late 1860s and now serves as an active clinical treatment and rehabilitation program for veterans across VA. And you can learn more about VA homeless programs at www.va.gov/homeless/dchv.asp. And that's Chasing the Next Healing, Journey from Addiction and Despair to Recovery and Hope with VA support. I'd like to return now to militarytimes.com for a movie review. In Waves and War shows promise of psychedelics to treat PTSD. This is from the 3rd of November by Clay Beiersdorfer. By the time the first quote from Homer's Odyssey fades from the screen, "By now I'm used to suffering, I have endured so much in Waves and War," it's clear what kind of story In Waves and War wants to tell. The new documentary from directors John Schenck and Bonnie Cohen is not about the battles Navy SEALs fought overseas, but the ones they continue to face long after the shooting stops. It's a film about endurance, recovery, and what happens when the toughest people in the world have to confront pain they can no longer muscle through. Premiering at the 2024 Telluride Film Festival and available to stream Monday on Netflix, In Waves and War follows a group of SEAL veterans struggling with the lasting effects of war. The men in the film carry both visible wounds and invisible ones, and they speak openly about the cost of years spent in combat and separation from family. Rather than centering on the operations that made them legends, Schenck and Cohen's cameras focus on what came afterward, the sleepless nights, the fractured relationships, and the fight to feel whole again. At the heart of the documentary is the question of whether psychedelic-assisted therapy can help veterans reclaim their lives. The film explores experimental treatments involving ibogaine and 5-MeO-DMT, two substances currently not approved for clinical use in the United States. The veterans travel to treatment centers in Mexico where these psychedelics are administered under medical supervision. For many of the film subjects, the treatment represents a last-ditch effort after years of failed prescriptions and therapy. The results, at least on screen, are startling. What begins as a documentary about pain gradually becomes a story about possibility. The film features several central figures, each with a distinct journey. Marcus Capone, a former SEAL whose wife describes him as a monster after returning from multiple deployments, becomes one of the movement's leading advocates. Through his nonprofit, Veterans Exploring Treatment Solutions, Capone helps others find the same lifeline he credits with saving his marriage and his life. DJ Shipley shares how the weight of two decades in the teams nearly destroyed the home he built with his wife, Patsy, who herself lost her first husband, Danny Dietz, in Operation Red Wings in Afghanistan. Matty Roberts, who suffered a devastating arm injury in combat, allows his treatment to be filmed in Mexico, offering viewers a rare look inside the process. The men's stories are presented without artifice. They speak directly to the camera. Their words are measured, but unguarded. There's no dramatization of the battlefield and no replay of missions, only a lingering echo of what those years took from them. What distinguishes In Waves and War from other post-9/11 veteran documentaries is its refusal to glamorize the military experience or pity those who served. Instead, it captures the reality of warriors learning to put down their armor. To visualize trauma and healing, Schenck and Cohen incorporate animation sequences from London-based studio AKA. The style is fluid, shifting between images of helicopters, night vision raids, and faces dissolving into smoke or sand. These transitions mirror how memory works, especially for those processing trauma. One moment, the viewer is in a desert firefight, the next, inside the mind of a man confronting his younger self. The effect is haunting, but it helps convey the internal experience of psychedelic therapy in a way words cannot. While the film hints at the risks of psychedelic treatments, it largely stays focused on the positive outcomes. Viewers never see a failed session or a relapse, and some may question whether the film's optimism leaves out important context. But in Waves and War is not pretending to be a clinical study. It's a personal one. Its power lies in allowing veterans to speak for themselves about what worked when nothing else did. The emphasis is on hope, not science. What keeps the film grounded is its honesty about how much healing still takes work. Psychedelic therapy is not portrayed as a magic cure, but as a catalyst. The real effort begins afterward when the participants return home and attempt to rebuild relationships and find purpose again. The film shows that facing trauma can be just as grueling as any deployment, but it is also an act of courage. The title, borrowed from ancient poetry, fits the story perfectly. In Waves and War captures how trauma recedes and returns like the tide, and how surviving it requires both endurance and surrender. For veterans who've spent their lives mastering control, surrender can be the hardest part. Shank and Cohen's film understands that and treats every subject with respect and restraint. This is not a political documentary, nor does it wade into debates about drug policy. Its focus is far more human. It asks what happens when warriors who have done everything right still cannot find peace, and what they're willing to risk to get it. Whether psychedelic therapy becomes mainstream or remains controversial, the courage it takes for these veterans to seek help is undeniable. In Waves and War stands alongside other post-9/11 works like Restrepo and Of Men and War, but with a quieter tone. It's less about combat, more about the long, uneven path toward recovery. By the final frame, it leaves viewers not with a sense of despair, but with a flicker of hope. Healing, it suggests, might be possible even for those who thought they were beyond saving. For service members and veterans watching, that message may be the most important mission of all. That's a movie review. In Waves and War shows promise of psychedelics to treat PTSD. That's from the militarytimes.com, and the movie will be available on Netflix. You've been listening to Weekly Reveille with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. I'd like to thank you for joining me for this week's edition of Weekly Reveille, and remind you that you can listen to Weekly Reveille and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming, streaming, or at a time of your choosing by going to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org, by downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app for the Android phone or tablet from the Google Play Store, or the Apple iPad or iPhone from the Apple App Store. And finally, you can listen to Weekly Reveille streaming on your Amazon Dot, Echo, or Show.